listener production.
A warning. This episode contains references to suicide, miscarriages, and infant loss. If this content affects you, dial Lifeline on 13 11 14. G'day, I'm former police officer Brent Sanders. And for the past 25 years, I've dedicated myself to sharing what I've learnt on the force to the Australian public so they can better protect themselves from falling victim to crime. So with the help of some of the most respected current and former detectives and high-ranking law enforcement agents, we're going to pull back the curtain on what life is like on the force and what they've learned about how crime and criminals really work. These are real stories from real detectives. This week, a New South Wales detective who paid the price for blowing the whistle on police corruption and the infamous Roger Rogerson.
As bad and as shitty as my life's been, I don't regret the choices I've made by being an honest cop.
Deborah Locke is a 12-year veteran of the New South Wales Police. As her career progressed, she learnt that for some police, being a good cop and being a good criminal were strangely very similar things.
That was the line in the sand for me with these guys.
We'll learn just how Deb blew the whistle on Rogerson and understand the life-threatening consequences she faced for doing so.
I didn't even know what a whistleblower was. I didn't even know the word.
But first, we're heading back to her family's reaction when she joined the force.
One of the most scariest persons I ever met in my life was Roger Rogerson. However, it was like kindergarten after being brought up by my mother. Irene was the most scariest person I ever met. So, my family, my grandfather used to ride a Harley. He was at Gallipoli in World War One. He had some fingers shot off. I remember him. And I had uncles that used to do the Wall of Death and ride bikes and other members of the family that wore colours. And so I came from a biker family. I remember I used to get thrown in the old HRU. My mother would turn up at Hell's Angel meets and she'd have me in front of her. It was like, you're going to go through the kid first to get to me. And I saw a lot of violence. I grew up with a lot of domestic violence. And the Finks came down from Queensland, had big gang wars with the Hells Angels when I was young. And so I was rebelling. I was rebelling against my family. And, you know, I remember my mother beating her chest going, what are people going to do? What are they going to say? You know, she didn't think it was a really good idea. And it's a similar story with Kim Hollingsworth, who was joined the police too and was, you know, in my story that was used with Underbelly 3 with the Golden Mile. And she came from police family. And she, her uncles, her father, she was brought up in a very, you know, middle class police environment. And she rebelled and ended up in the cross as a prostitute, and so did her two sisters. In the show, they showed one sister. There was two sisters that ended up there. And, you know, Kim and I, we came from totally different backgrounds, and yet we both ended up in King's Cross in the 80s.
So, Deb, you go into the job, you'd have been 19. I think you were one of the last intakes at Redfern before the police academy went down to Goulburn. That time, Deb, handful of women going through. In fact, up until that point when you joined the job, the only work that female police officers could undertake were working on sexual assault cases and I think some education programs in the schools.
Yeah, a bit of school lecturing. And the girls were token gestures. They wore dresses, had handbags.
The handbag one's one that makes me laugh. That's a classic, isn't it? The handbag.
They were just there to do the girly stuff.
Yeah.
And they weren't taken seriously. And it was Christine Nixon and a couple of, she had uncles and that were high up in the police and she'd made a bit of noise and they'd let them answer the phones at King's Cross. And they found out that the girls could do it. Surprise, surprise. And then they found out that when they let the girls on the street, and at that stage from 82 to 84, they were letting them out at North Sydney and King's Cross, they found that the women were better in a violent situation to sort of calm down the environment. You know, they were quite good at the jobs. And they girls started wearing culottes. They started wearing police pants. They were actually doing police work because before 82, once you got engaged, you had to leave. You had to resign from your job. And I don't know what that was all about. Magically, you got engaged. You might be going to get married or have children or have sex with a man or what was going on. But once you got engaged, you were out. Your career was over. So the only older women that were in the police were spinsters.
The idea that you could lose your job for getting engaged or you could lose your job for falling pregnant is, see, we have all these protections now. We have all anti-discrimination legislation, protected attributes, and we have it because of what used to happen in workplaces around Australia before it. Now, nothing's perfect. Nothing will ever be perfect, but goodness me, it's almost hard to believe, isn't it, sitting here, that in your time in the job, those were the conditions.
Well, when I fell pregnant, I wasn't married. And what was dished out to me was horrendous. How I was treated, you know, was incredible.
Deb, you have paid an incredibly high price during your time in the job and your commitment to pushing back against corruption. We'll revisit some of those times in the fraud squad. If I could, you would have graduated around 84, 85. Not long after that, you were posted to the King's Cross around 1986. A notorious, somewhat less than salubrious reputation looking back. You're a young female police officer in the King's Cross. Can you just give us an insight to the environment, to what it was like arriving there at that time?
Well, I got sent there as a woodchuck. It was like a undercover drug squad sort of set up. And what had happened was I'd had a very dangerous situation. Maybe I can just explain how I got there. There was a very dangerous situation. I was doing prison van duty from Long Bay Jail. And I'd known quite a few people that had been in prison. They always treated everyone as human beings. I was always very smiley and, you know, I didn't treat them like a blue uniform normally would. And we'd gone to Long Bay Jail and picked up the guys to go to court. And in the prison van, like I'd be sitting in the front to go to Long Bay Jail, but on the way to the court, I'd sit in this little bit at the back, which was worse than when the prisoners were. You couldn't breathe. It was just a little tiny compartment where I sat sideways with my gun. And then I'd help get the prisoners out at each court where they had to appear for court. And I'm going along and this guy gets out and goes to court and I smile at him. I say, look, good luck, mate. Have a good day. Wish you all the best. And I had a bit of a joke with him. And van takes off again. I'm feeling car sick. It's horrible. You know, I'm sitting in the back of this van and we're driving for about 10 minutes. And then the door opens and there's a couple of detectives. There's uniform cops behind and they're pushing me and pulling me out of the cabin. And then they open the back door and they drag one of the prisoners out by the hair and they're absolutely flogging him in the street and they're dragging him into the courthouse. And he's screaming. The cops are screaming. They grab me. I'm in the back, you know, and then I'm in the front and I had no idea what was going on. But what happened was that prisoner that I was really kind to had gone into the courtroom and he'd realised I was a young girl. I don't think I was 20. And he said, that guy who's going to the next courthouse, he's killed his wife and a couple of blokes. He's got a little replica gun in his pants and he's going to shoot her in the head. He's going to get a gun off a shooter in the head and get away. And no one could believe that a crim had seen mercy on me and lagged on another crim, you know, because he would have copped it when he got back to Long Bay. He saw mercy on me. I'd just been kind to him. Like, unfortunately, in my time in the police, sometimes the biggest crims were kinder and nicer to me than some of the cops were.
It saved your life. It's not being melodramatic to say that, is it?
And I don't know why. I think he just thought, see, this is a young, hopeless girl. You know, like I didn't have a chance. He would have got my gun off me so easily.
So that you're 20, that's probably around 85 or thereabouts. You've moved from that to the Cross around 86. Is that around about the timeline? Yep. King's Cross, 1986. What's it like?
wow, it was rocking and rolling. Mm. It was wild.
Mm.
And in those days, the Cross was run by Lenny McPherson. And Lenny was a gentleman. He was a businessman. He wore a suit. He was polite. He had manners. It was a time when the powers of the Cross was changing from the Aussies to the Lebanese, and Louis Bayer and Billy Bayer were taking over. And Louis was a kind guy. He liked to buy the cops lots of drinks and that. And Billy was more drugs. He was very, only ever saw him in dark, shady places. So, but then from them, it was handed over to John Ibrahim. So there's been a real transition. And now, yeah, I could go to the Cross and it's dead. Mm. Now the life of this generation is down at Newtown. It's all yuppie and trendy and they're drinking water and eating mung beans and it's a different era. Like what went on in the 80s and 90s was just crazy. They were still doing the Wild Wild West in New South Wales, you know. Nettie Smith had been given a green light from Roger Rogerson. Like he was allowed to do anything except for kill a cop down. Mm-hmm. He was given the green light for whatever he did. And Abbo Henry and all the other great characters of the time, like it was out of control.
Mm. It's interesting. I drove through the King's Cross literally a couple of days ago and bourbon and beefsteak's been pulled down. Now, you would have spent or rubbed shoulders with those. That was like a police bar at that time.
It actually was. Between 4 and 5, it was free drinks and little hot seafood hors d'oeuvres for the police. And
yes.
So, you know, they looked after the cops because we were right next to it with the King's Cross Police Station. And where I was down in the dungeon under the ground there. So it was good days. It was lots of drinking. I've got 31 years up sober tomorrow. Continual sobriety if I don't drink tonight. Like it's been a long 31 years and it took me quite a few years to get sober. You know, I did an awful lot of drinking, you know, because that was part of the culture. It was part of doing undercover and surveillance work. The gaming squad, they used to give us $10 cash. We'd line up for it from the old sergeants and we'd get $10 every Saturday and Wednesday to go drink in 3 pubs to look for SP bookies. Like part of my job was to drink alcohol. But in those days, there was no OH&S. There was no welfare where they were, you know, warned you that how we were living and the stress of it all and for so long would take its toll on us.
And Deb, would it be fair to say, as a young new constable in the Cross and female, you're working pretty hard also to try and be accepted by the older male police and things like that, because that can't have been an easy road. And so socialising, drinking, it's part of that inclusion process, I guess.
Oh, God, yeah. I really wanted to be one of the boys. You know, I was doing a boy job. I was as loud as the boys. I could swear better than the boys, you know. I just wanted to belong. You know, I didn't fit into my biological family and here it was, my police family. I loved it. I loved being a cop. You know, it was fun. We used to laugh a lot. Every shift you wouldn't know what you were going to come across or what you were going to do. And they were my family.
There's a story that you tell where you come to the front desk and there's a woman there, I think with a broken arm, a woman by the name of Sally Ann Huckstep. Can you just explain that exchange for us and you know, what happened shortly afterwards?
Sally Ann was Lan French's girlfriend and she'd gone on television. She'd gone on, I think it was 60 Minutes or Current Affair or something, Channel 9. She'd gone on and said, the police are corrupt. I'm a whistleblower. The police are corrupt. Roger Rogerson shot my boyfriend. He didn't have a gun on him when he left and it was just an out-and-out cold-blooded killing. This sergeant at King's Cross told me that Roger had ripped the phone cords from along the wall and wrapped them around Sally Ann's neck and she was going black in the face. And someone stopped him. Like the boys in the office said, you can't kill her here. Anyway, it's a bourbon and beef night, 4 to 5. All the boys are out getting drinks and I've been delegated as the girlie to answer the phones for that hour. And yeah, it was just my luck that day. And I got a phone call from upstairs from the station front saying there was a girl at the front of the police station that wanted to talk to a detective. So I went up, I went out, and it was Sally Ann. And I knew Sally Ann. You could tell Sally Ann because she had the big gap between her teeth. And she was a pretty girl and big drug addict and prostitute. And she's going, oh, I don't want to talk to you. You're a woodchuck.
Now, what does that – just explain what a woodchuck is for those listening.
Well, it was a derogatory term for us young coppers that were there on secondment to work at the cross. Like, but she knew. She was so in with the cops that she knew what we were called. And she's going, Roger hurt my arm. She had a sore arm. And she's going, you know, she was very distressed, and it was just, you know, she ended up walking away from me. And next thing you know, she's dead. She's in Centennial Park, and she'd been given a speedball. She had such a high tolerance to drugs that apparently the story is that they stood on a chest in the pond to kill her. They drowned her.
Just to be clear, this was the following day.
Yeah.
So she's come to the station. You've come up to see her. She's not interested in talking to you because in her view, you're just junior. That's not going to be worth talking. She walks away. Within 24 hours,
she's
found dead in a pond at Centennial Park. A homicide that later was proven to be committed by whom?
Well, I don't think anyone's got a Guernsey for that yet, but it was Roger, sort of like was the main force behind everything that was going on.
The puppeteer, if you will.
The puppeteer. Like, you know, you had the players at the time and you got Nettie Smith. Nettie Smith, I think, was nominated as one of the main characters involved in it and that. But you got Mr. Rennekill in that with the shooting of Michael Drury, and he ended up dead and disappearing, like, after that. Like, it was a time where people just seemed to disappear and die around Roger. You know, it was just a crazy time. Like, it was just he was out of control.
From the cross, you moved around about that time, 86, a little later perhaps, into Gaming Squad. Can you just explain again to those listening, what is the Gaming Squad? What is the role? What's that all about?
It was a funny place. It was a time when we didn't have casinos run by the government at the time. And there was a rule, if there was more than 8 old Greek men playing at a table in a room, well, then it was a criminal offence and there'd be raids and they'd get them. And oh my God, the Gaming Squad. When the Woodrow Commission came, there was all these whole squads that were just shut down, and the Gaming Squad was one of them. There was a Sorting Squad and there was a Surveillance Squad and there was all different squads that they shut down, but certainly the Gaming Squad. And that was about 60 men. And I went into that squad and I was the only woman there. I knew that a woman had left earlier that had copped a hard time. And you got these drunken men, and there was different sections, and you'd have a sergeant in front of a section, and that section would be in charge of the Asian gaming. And then you'd have the ones that liaised on and worked on doing the Greeks, and then you'd have ones that worked on doing the Lebanese. And it was a place where there wasn't many arrests. It was a place where there was a lot of drinking, and we were given, I think I said it earlier, you know, we'd get drinking money tax-free. And the fact that it was so dangerous working in a squad with all those men and the alcohol and that for my own safety, I was moved into the surveillance squad. And there was one woman in the surveillance squad. And, you know, and that was a smaller group of 5. And so it just out on the floor, it was just too rough and it was like cowboys. But there was a lot of money changing hands every time we went to do a raid at one stage. You know, they'd know we were coming. You know, they'd be tipped off beforehand. And it got to the point where in the office we'd all get locked in if there was going to be a job on and we were going to raid a gaming place. And I'd get escorted to the toilet. You know, even as the only woman there, you know, it was like, we're going to make sure we're going to do this raid. No one's going to take any money before the raid and tip them off because they're all fighting to get to each other to get the money from, you know, we'll tip you off, you know. And it was just crazy. And one time we went and we knocked a door down and they were all waiting for us and they had big spreads of food and everything. They had a big welcome sign for us. And they had a guy there to video us, to make a home video of us raiding the joint. And we had our video guy videoing them, videoing us, and it was just crazy. It was frustrating because you just couldn't get an arrest, you know. And even if the SP bookies were caught, it wasn't about getting caught. It was about their ledger, because their ledger of bets was where all the money was. And if a bookie couldn't pay out on his bets, if he lost who made bets and what amount and that, it was all over, Red Rover. Like, so that ledger of paper with all the bets on it was the most valuable thing. So there was a big price on a ledger, and they would do things like shred them, and we'd sit there and try and put them together, or they'd have paper that dissolved in water and they'd have buckets of water there. So if we raided, they would put the ledgers in the water. But to keep their ledger, a lot of money changed hands, and a lot of money did change hands. In fact, I had $10,000 in the boot of my police car one night. So, you know, just crazy times.
And working surveillance, the five car follows, the SP bookies, can you just bend on
I'm
that?
I'm a bit dyslexic and I struggle with north, south, east and west and stuff and that. And it was just a nightmare. Like, we'd have one car, one person, one bunny, and normally be me, sitting off the place watching, keeping the eyeball for when the SP bookie would leave their house in the morning. And then we'd follow and we'd keep overtaking each other. So every time he looked behind him, because he'd be doing anti-surveillance, hoping the cops weren't watching him, we'd change the cars. And so we'd overtake and leapfrog and work through the group. And for me, I'd have to not lose sight of someone or I'd be out of the circus, because they'd be on the police radios. We'd on back channels, and we had undercover cars that had radios in their glove box and hidden aerials. And it was all, you know, very, very sophisticated for the time. Even at times, sometimes we'd use a helicopter. We'd have the police helicopter up in the sky following a person, a bookie that was leaving his house. And, you know, it was a hard game. You might follow them so far to a place and then you'd have to back off because it's getting too red hot. And then the next week you'd pick him up there and follow him. And so it was interesting work, but there was so much corruption there that it was very hard to actually do your job.
Mm-hmm. And almost impossible to push back against for someone who was a relatively junior officer. You're just doing what you're told, and you it's very, very difficult to push back against that.
Yeah, it was a crazy play. It was like a circus. Like, it was like you're just going, what is it? That was cowboys again. It was the 80s. It was mobile phones were just, I think, going in. I remember mobile phones in big briefcases and that. So I remember in an undercover job, running down to a phone box and looking for 20-cent coins to ring because I'd been, you know, my cover had been blown. And I thought, I'm going to die here. They're going to find out I'm an undercover cop. And trying to get 20-cent coins so I can phone in to say I'm in trouble. Like, just crazy.
Am I right? Did you do 6 or 7 years undercover work and surveillance work?
Yeah.
1 year is a whole lot. 6 or 7 years in that environment, that's tough, isn't it?
People shouldn't do more than two, they reckon. But I was twitching. I had a total breakdown at the end. And I drank. And that's what they'd say. At the end of a bad shift, they'd always say, are you all right? And then they'd go, all right, well, we'll go to the pub and have a drink and we'll debrief about this. And then you're right. It's like, don't care. I remember one stage I was a real mess and my boss going to me, now you're going to go in the bathroom. I'm going to send you to the doctor and you're going to put makeup on. And I'm going, oh, I don't wear makeup, you know. And he got some makeup for me from this other girl. And he said, you're going to put makeup on, you're going to go to the doctor's. And then I went and I said, oh, I'm pretty, pretty stuffed. And then I got back and he goes, see, you're all right. You managed to put makeup on, so you're okay. And it's like, I'm sure things have improved a bit since then, but it was just crazy. Like, it was pump up, be a man. I got told to pull myself up by my bootstraps at one occasion. You know, it was like, just have a drink and you'll be right. And the trouble is, like, as a cop, every shift, every day when you go to your shift, you don't know if you're going to make it or not, you know, and this is all cops. And they always say to you at the academy, they say, be nice to your missus. That's how they talk, because there wasn't many girls there. Don't leave on an angry note because you may not come home. Make sure that everything's good at home when you leave for work in the morning. You know, tell her you love her. Make it nice because, you know, sometimes cops don't come home. Like, it's the hardest job in the world, you know. And I admire all police. The only thing I didn't like was corrupt police. And I've always stood up against corruption. Whistleblowers Australia, the meetings started in my lounge room at Balmain. Like, you know, we used to meet there and I didn't even know what a whistleblower was. I didn't even know the word. When I blew the whistle on Roger Rogerson, and I ended up eventually in front of Tony Lauer, who they said to me, John Avery was the commissioner. And they said, we're not going to tell John Avery, he's about to get out, but Tony Lauer's going to be the next commissioner. You're going to meet with him. And I met with him. And the guy was looking at me like I was dirt. He was angry. He couldn't look at me. He was disgusted. And in the end, he said, you're a whistleblower. And I'd never heard the word before. And so I built up, you know, it was the bravery to say to him, look, what's a whistleblower? I'm thinking, shit, this sounds like a really bad thing. And he said, police who dob in other police. And that was the first time I ever heard the words. And I said, look, I said, Roger's doing shit. Roger's doing this and he's doing that and this is going on. And he looked at me and he goes, you don't know what a detective is. So, you know, and at that stage, Roger wasn't even a detective, but he was certainly still running some of the detectives. So it was just Madville.
And just for clarity there, this gentleman that you're talking about, the commissioner, Tony Lauer, I mean, I guess this is just endemic of how high up this stuff was coming down. When even the New South Wales Police Commissioner at the time was dismissive of you because you had the audacity to call out corrupt police.
Yeah.
He resigned at the start of the Wood Commission after, amongst other things, claiming that there was no corruption at all in the King's Cross Police detectives and things. So interesting character.
Oh, very interesting. Went off to be head of a church for Australia. So, but he did say at the time of the Wood Royal Commission that sometimes he did cross against the lights, you know, when it was a red light. Sometimes he did do the wrong thing. Well, he certainly did the bloody wrong thing to me that day when I went to him for help.
Now, just talking about when you went to him, if we can do a half step back, you left the gaming squad and you went to work with Parramatta Detectives.
Yes.
And I think it was at that time Rogerson had been removed from New South Wales Police, but strangely, he's back in a sort of a private company consultancy type role, still with some bizarre involvement with the New South Wales Police.
Yeah, well, I had to leave the game. It's for my own physical safety, and that's why I went to Parramatta Detectives. And I ended up from the frying pan into the fire. You know, my first shift at Parramatta, my new partner said, we're going to go do a break and enter. And he was getting me to fill out this break and enter form, like, you know, to take the complaint. And they're going, don't worry, you know, this garage was broken in here. It was a screwdriver and all this stuff was gone. You make the list of the stuff. And there was no bloody break and enter. Like, just from the day I walked in, from the moment I walked into Parramatta, it was the same garbage going on, you know.
So just expand upon that. So why is he getting you to report a break and enter if there wasn't one?
For the insurance claim.
And the insurance claim is connected to Rogerson, possibly how?
Well, it was just the stuff they'd do. Like, it wasn't long before I'm sitting in a Chinese restaurant and Roger's there, and the coppers all had these beautiful big chunky gold rings on, and there was some guys from a used car business, and that was another little racket going on, but there was this Chinese, big tall Chinese guy, and he had a jewellery store, and all the coppers had nice big gold rings on. They're all admiring them and they're getting drunker and drunker and, you know, and apparently this Chinese guy had his jewellery store robbed and there was a big insurance claim too. And so this is the sort of stuff that was a bit of a celebration dinner over it all, and everyone got a drink out of it and obviously a gold ring, and it was just very blatant. And Roger wasn't happy that I was there. Actually, Roger always hated me. He had a few goes at me in the media. He had a real problem with me, Roger. And that day he was quite, he wasn't holding back on me. Like, he made it quite clear he wasn't happy that I was there that day.
An incident or a situation around this time, Deb, you're in a pub at Parramatta. Lenny McPherson's there, you know, labelled as the King of the Cross. And I think somebody hands to you a gun licence with McPherson's wife's name on it. Just explain that. The process there, what was going on and what they were trying to do with all that.
Oh, I got called down. I got a phone call. I was in the office and I walked down the Park Royal, and that's a bit flash. That was a bit flasher than where the boys normally went, and probably because Lenny was there. And Lenny's just sitting there glaring at me at a table. And
I'm taken out the back and I'm given this gun license. And in those days, like, it was like a paper, just a piece of paper that had been filled out and badly filled out, bad drunken handwriting. And I it was probably filled out over the lunch. And he's going, just go and pay it. Just go and pay it at the counter. Go to Gladesville Police Station. And I'm going, are you mental? Like, do you think I'm going to do that? You know, and I've got it in my head. And then he's pulling out a wad of money. He's going, come on, I'll give you some money. He kept going up and up and up. And I'm just going and I'm pushing it back at him. But what happened was when I left, and that was a moment where I had a lot of strength to do that. Like it was, you know, I was intimidated a lot by these big men. Like they used to be all over 6'2" when they joined the club. These are all great big ex-footballers and that. And I just knew, it's like, here we go again. They're trying to get something on me, get me to do something corrupt so that I'm part of the thing. And what happened was that night I'm in bed shaking because I've suddenly realised my fingerprints are on that licence. My fingerprints are on that licence. And I'm just going, they got me. Even though I didn't take any money, they got me. And that's, and at around that time, there was another time I was sitting in a bar with a very senior cop and we were both drinking. And he said to me, looked at me and he said, what's the worst thing you ever done? What's the worst thing you ever done? And I said, oh, no, I've done some pretty bad things, I suppose. I don't know, you know. Yeah, and I'm going, you know, drank for some funny, told him some funny stories, you know. And then I said, what have you done? What's the worst thing you've ever done? And he said, I've taken money off a pedophile. And my blood went cold. And I just shook my head and I said, but you've got kids. And he said, yeah, but I know who they all are. My kids are safe. And that was the line in the sand for me with these guys. You know, I just, you know, it was just ridiculous. And this whole pedophilia thing, that was meant to come up at the Wood Royal Commission. It took another 20 years. Like Franca Arena stood up in Parliament and she was shot down and that it was just too big. It was overnight. It was all just shut down. We're not going to talk about the pedophiles and the people in high places and, you know, and we saw Judge Yellman committed suicide at the Wood Royal Commission. He was called in and he hung himself the morning of he was meant to give evidence. And there'd been a history of special squad walking him out of toilets at Central Railway Station and that with young boys, you know, when he was caught in that. Like money and power goes with one branch of the pedophilia. And there was cops taking money. You know, it was all the Dolly Dunn stuff and cat, but that was the tip of the iceberg. What they touched on pedophilia, that was just too big. There was too many people involved. And you know, it was just awful.
You got flicked to a place, Deb, banished, I think is probably a good term, the Hat Factory. Now, was this the commissioner who made this decision? Can you explain the Hat Factory? You're there with Michael Drury.
Yeah. Michael Drury was MC at my wedding. I was at my lowest in my life then. Like, you know, and that was because of the commissioner. It was basically he didn't know what to do with me after I've come to him with all this stuff. And he's going, and he said, look, Roger wants to get Michael. He wants to get you. You've upset Roger now. And what do we do with you? We'll put you both together. You can go under Michael's wing and work with these gotcha cars and stay in the old Hat Factory. And we'll keep you away from the police because we can't protect you. We can't protect your physical safety from Roger Rogerson. And so I was devastated. I was gutted. I was humiliated. You know, I'd done the right thing and I felt like I was being punished.
Gotcha cars. Just give us a once over there. What's going on here?
Oh, it was like Ted Pickering was a police minister and it was like he had this idea. He loved gadgets and he had this idea of these old cars and when a person broke into one to steal them, these bolts would shut on the doors and he wanted smoke to come up and sign saying you've been caught in a gotcha car. And they realised if the baddie had asthma, they couldn't do that. But he wanted to see it as a new phase in policing. And I was in this factory away from mainstream policing, and we never caught anyone in a gotcha car. You know, we'd leave them open. We'd go to Vinnie's and buy handbags, and people would ring up and say, oh, there's a car there with a handbag in it. It's not locked. Like, they were such crappy old cars that no self-respecting crook would ever want to steal one. And the little bolts in the door would rust and fall out. And it was just humiliating. It was just awful. And, you know, and I thought, oh, well, they're saving petrol on Roger. They can come and get me and Michael at the same time, you know, do it in one trip. And, you know, I just shut my curtains at night. You know, Irene was hysterical. She was so angry. Like, she's going, they shot Michael. They're going to shoot you. And so I had this stress. Like, I had these chronic alcoholic parents that I was looking after. Like, my life was hell. And I just, you know, I nearly died. It was just a point in my life where I just, it was so awful. And, you know, and I nearly did die. I had an ectopic pregnancy while I was there, and I was in hospital for a month. And it was then that I had a month in hospital to sit and not have a drink and look at my life and how bad it was. And it was just shit. And I just thought, I can't go back and just keep hiding, you know. And so against everyone's advice, I went to the fraud squad. I went, Michael, I'm leaving. I'm going. I'm a mess. I need to clean my act up. You know, I'll go to the fraud squad. You wear suits. Mm-hmm. I thought, oh, I can't get in trouble at the fraud. They're the most boring people in the world. They're just doing bank stuff, you know.
So this is stepping away from the work that you'd been doing, which was primarily undercover work, surveillance work, that type of thing, stepping away from that, away from the heavy drinking and stuff on, you know, and all that type of thing, to go to, like what you say, the fraud squad, which is a bit more white collar.
Yeah. I was a senior constable by then, a designated detective.
Mm.
And I thought, I'm going to go do detective work. You know, I'd been a bit of a disaster at Parramatta, but I thought, how can I get in trouble at the fraud squad? Like, you know, the Gaiman squad was bad. Parramatta was a disaster. That was just horrifying, the stuff that went on there. And I thought, and then it was just slow death in the hat factory, waiting to die, waiting for Roger to get me and or get myself, you know, with the state I was in. My mental health was just shot. And I just thought, all right, I'm going to pull myself together and I'm going to go to the fraud squad.
And how did that end up for you?
Well, I'm doing a job and I'm sitting in this beautiful, at the cassette, this beautiful flash motel room in Perth. I'm sitting in Perth. I'm going, this is a good job, you know, like, and I'm thinking, wait a minute. Suddenly the penny drops. Like, I'm blonde. I'm a little bit slow. And I'm going, wait a minute, cops don't pay for flash motel. This is ridiculous, you know. And all of a sudden I realised, I was doing a Roger Rogerson job for his private inquiry agency. Even though he was out of the cops, they were using police time and police resources and that to go and do jobs for Roger.
That he was on the payroll.
For his clients.
Yeah.
For his business. We were working for his business.
So he's got his fingerprints are over senior people in the fraud squad as well at that time.
Oh, well, you could say that. Yeah. So I was sitting in Perth going, bloody Roger. Like, it was like, it's a joke. Like, I was very happy when he died. And when him and Glenn, and I knew Glenn, and I accidentally regret supporting Glenn. Glenn wrote two books, and there was a media article where he's got his arm around me up the cross and I'm supporting him as an honest cop and, you know.
Glenn McNamara,
you know. And little did I know that years later Glenn and Roger would, you know, be involved in the killing of Jamie Gow. And but when they went to trial for that murder, I was there most days waving at him. I was giving him a little wave going, hi, Glenn, hi, Roger. Like, you know, Roger told me that I was an effing idiot, that I never took money. And it's like, I'm free. I could jump out of that courtroom and I could go buy a sandwich. They were going back down to the cells at the end of the day. Like, like, as bad and as shitty as my life's been, I don't regret the choices I've made by being an honest cop. Like, you know, they made choices and they, you know, and the opinion was that I was an idiot. But who's laughing now? You know, they both got a life sentence. Like, Roger didn't expect to die in jail. That was the last thing he ever. The guy was a psychopath. He was a narcissist. He was highly intelligent and a great bloke to have drinks with. But I'm sure he was very shocked at how his circus ended.
Mm. Fraud squad, you fell pregnant?
I did.
Went down well?
They were so impressed. They were like, they're going, well, you got to resign now. You got to go. And I'm going, no. I don't. And they're going, yeah, it's over. You're going.
They've got you.
They got me. And my life was hell. And then when I fell pregnant again, I got 12 months maternity leave. And I was told, come back early. We're short of staff. Come back. Don't take your 12 months off. Come back. And I went back after about 4 or 5 months. And the day I walked in the office, I was taken into the kitchen. I was sat on this stool and I was screamed at. I was absolutely berated and screamed at. And I sat there and I had my head down. And the only thing I could think of was, I'm pregnant again. I'm not going to be here for long. And unfortunately, it was only a matter of weeks after that treatment that I had a miscarriage. And they said to me, they said, you don't think you had that miscarriage because of the way we've been treating you? And my doctor, my gynecologist, did tests on the baby girl. And he said there was nothing wrong with that child. And it was, he believed that stress was a serious and major contributing factor to me losing my baby daughter. And I was just absolutely tortured for being a woman. And, you know, and I know this is not the story of every woman at that time, but unfortunately I was in places as a detective, as plain clothes, and going into environments like those guys. Yeah, I was the fifth ever woman at the fraud squad, like, and, you know, I was one of the first at the game. It's like, it was environments where they'd been there a long time. The world had changed around them. They were dinosaurs in an enclosed environment. They didn't realise that they couldn't treat me the way they were treating me. And I was strong enough to pull them on and just go, enough's enough.
Deb, after all of this, what was thrown at you and everything that you had to go through, you're asked to, or approached to give evidence in the Wood Royal Commission?
What happened was John Hatton was an independent politician, and for 20 years he was trying to speak out about corruption. And eventually I joined them and I went, yep, there's corruption. Da-da-da-da was there corruption. And we used to have little meetings, and it was the balance of power that was with the independents. And it was just a fluke bit in history. And I did eight stat decks for John Hatton, describing current corruption that was occurring with Roger at the gaming squad, at the fraud squad, and other incidences. And we went, right, let's go get some more cops. Let's get some more people to back us up. And I remember flying with John Hatton in a little four-seater plane through a storm to Canberra to try and get a signature off someone who backed out at the last minute because they were too square. The normal answer by most cops was, oh, I've got a wife and a mortgage, or Roger will kill me, or I'll be ostracised, or my career will be over. And we tried and tried and tried. We could not get one other police officer in the whole of the New South Wales Police Force to sign on the dotted line on stack debt to say, yes, there was corruption. And anyway, in the end, Hatton had to go to Parliament House with just my evidence. And the thing was, like I said, I'm 31 years sober tomorrow, but the thing was there was a lot of rubbish thrown at me. They're going, oh, she's a drunk. And when I was in the box at the Royal Commission, in the end, they were told to shut up. And they're going, well, is she drunk now? No. Is she sober? Yep. Is she what she's saying, the truth? Yes. And it's going, well, let's just get on with it. You know, let's just, what's happening here? And so what happened was, once they got the Royal Commission, it's the first time ever in the history of a major commission or investigation, they used cameras and listening devices and on police. And the rest of the world now has followed. And it was the first time. Like, and so no one ever expected it. What happened? They had cameras in cars and that. And Trevor Haken was a drunk. And he rolled over. They got him and he rolled over at the cross. And he said later on, you know, I'm sorry I rolled over. I would have preferred to have gone to jail than what happened to me blowing the whistle on these people. You know, because your life's over, your career's over. You know, I loved being a cop. All I wanted to do was be a cop, but they wouldn't let me because I was honest, because I'd just go, this is wrong, what's happening here. This is not on.
The Woodrawer Commission ran 95 to 97.
Yeah.
2 years. 19 arrested, I guess primarily police, quite senior ranking. 19 committed suicide.
Yeah.
380 walked from the police giving up any likelihood of pension or anything like that.
Yeah, they took the amnesty.
And just to be clear, you're the only New South Wales police officer who gave or provided stat deck or gave evidence, or you and a couple of others in that commission?
I was the only one that gave evidence to get the Royal Commission. No cop would stand up with Hatton at Parliament House and say there was corruption.
Right.
And even Tony Lau, the commissioner at the time, was saying, oh, there's one or two bad apples. And I think he thought I was a bad apple because I'd spoken out. But no one would admit it. And until the photos and the cameras came out of Chucky Fowler and that taking money off Trevor Haken and all the slipping on milkshakes and all the money changing hands, until then, you know, and it had never been done before. It had never been done ever. So the world changed with the technology. The world changed too because of mobile phones. Like with a mobile phone, anyone can video or tape someone. Like, you know, and there's more cameras everywhere. And even you can see when Roger Rogerson was arrested for the murder, they had like a video when they hooked up all the cameras along the streets from shops and traffic lights and everything. You know, the cameras outside the storage room where they killed the young Asian boy, you know. It was like a movie, like the world, there's cameras everywhere now. So how the boys were behaving before, back in the days where the police could get up in court and say, oh, yes, he admitted to me he did that crime, and that was a verbal. Like the police would stand in court and people would be convicted on the police evidence that they said at the time. It wouldn't be a signed statement. You know, they said, oh, yeah, too good for me, Sergeant Bloggs, I did it. There was a little bit of verbaling going on. So with mobile phones, it's a whole new world, a whole new world. It's all changed.
Deb, you had a husband in the police at the time, stayed in the job for a year or two longer after you'd left. Is it melodramatic to say that through this period that you felt genuine fear for your life and the life of perhaps even your husband?
Did we? What? And he was put in hiding in the undercover drug squad under the wing of Michael Drury again. Michael Drury came to the rescue again. And for his personal safety, they just couldn't protect us. They couldn't protect us from corrupt police. And so he was taken out of mainstream policing and, you know, and he actually ended up going a bit nutty and he punched a window and cut his arm and he lost the power in two fingers and he couldn't shoot his police gun anymore. And that's why he had to leave, you know, because of the pressure he was under and how he was still being treated because he was my husband. You know, he got his police pension because of how he was treated because he was married to Deborah Locke, because he was married to a police whistleblower. Like, how ridiculous. And I said to him, I begged him, I said, sort Roger out. Like, all I want to do is come to work. Just give me a safe working environment. And they're going, oh, we put out the spot fires, you know. It's easier for you to go than take on the corruption. So they ended up with the Woodrawer Commission. Like, you know, it's like it was out of control. If they're killing people, if they're taking money off pedophiles, if they're taking money, and this is a small portion of the police force. And please let me state here, most police are heroes. Most of them are strong. They put their life on the line every day. I love cops. I was a cop. I loved being a cop. I love police. But I don't like corrupt bastards.
Deb, I just want to thank you so very much for taking the time to come in and have a chat with us. I was so looking forward and excited to having this time with you and having this chat with you. But I didn't realise how amazing this discussion was going to be. Thank you for your service. I mean, 12 years of what you had to go through, but also the work that you have done since then and your absolute determination to keep getting back up off the canvas. I just want to thank you so very much for who you are and everything that you've done.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that because I haven't had many thank yous. So thank you.
Crime Insiders Detectives is a listener original production. It's hosted by me, Brent Sanders, produced by Ed Gooden, and sound designed and imaged by Link Kelly.